For the week of December 20th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 34, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I am Karen Woodward.
And from Santa's workshop at the North Pole, I'm Michael Gross.
Oh, cool! Hey, Santa, will you bring me a new laptop?
Well, you got to get your request into Nick a lot earlier than this, but I'll let him know.
Oh, okay. You're on first name basis now with Santa. That's good.
Oh, he hates Saint. He hates Saint Nick. Yeah, you got to call him Nick.
Well, now, do not be alarmed. That noise you hear is just the motion picture industry breathing a collective sigh of relief.
Because Avatar did well?
Yes, because
it didn't. It wasn't a disaster. I have to admit, I felt like all the coverage was sort of like everybody's just too, you know, sometimes there's a big movie and they have the guns out, and sometimes everybody just wants it to succeed because there's too much money involved. And I felt like the reviews reflected that because this movie's a piece of junk.
But, you know, all my nerd boy friends, and I mean that in the best way, guys, who have seen this are like just pissing in their pants. They love it so much.
Wow, you're kidding me. I've yet to meet anyone who liked it.
Well, I saw it, and I really enjoyed it. I thought, yes, it is derivative. It's got stilted dialogue, as James Rocky mentioned in our last episode. But in the end, it was engaging, and it was a spectacle.
Well, I think that you helped contribute. You and I helped contribute to the box office gross of that movie, which was strong. And worldwide, it was pretty good. Avatar was, of course, the number one movie of the weekend. It grossed $77 million. Despite a massive snowstorm that hit the East Coast and despite a Thursday night midnight screening that was really weak and had me sort of rubbing my hands and going, ooh, this movie could be a flop, but it's far from it. It grossed $77 million in the U.S. and an impressive total, including that $77 million, of $240 million worldwide. So it's off to a solid start. And if word of mouth is indeed good and there's repeat business, they should be fine. Teen girls went to see Titanic. If teen boys go to see Avatar, they'll be okay. The number two movie at the box office way down was The Princess and the Frog, which fell by 50% and is only at $44 million and looks like a very weak offering indeed. You can't make these movies for less than $100 million, and this has got to be a bit of a disappointment for Disney. They'll probably be okay once everything is added up, but it's not great.
It made $12 million this weekend, 12.9.
Yeah, it dropped by 50%, and its total is only $44 million, and it already feels like it's losing steam, I think. I don't think it's going to do that well throughout the holiday weekend, but we'll see. Number three is The Blind Side at $10 million for a total of $164 million. Sandra Bullock is the biggest female star in the world. Did you hear about The Morgans opened very weakly at $6.6 million? The Twilight Saga is still chugging along. It's at $274 million total. Invictus is falling quickly. It only made $4.2 million for $15 million total. A Christmas Carol is just about petered out. It's at $130 million compared to the $200 million budget. Up in the Air is still in very limited release. It made $3.2 million. It's on 175 screens, and it's going to go wide on Christmas Day, so it'll be fascinating to see how well it does. Brothers, the Tobey Maguire, Jake Gyllenhaal movie, is at $22 million total, which is pretty good for a small little film like this. And Old Dogs is at $43 million. So we're sort of just holding our breath about Avatar to see how it does second weekend and waiting for that Christmas Day explosion of movies. Why did you not go see Avatar, Karen?
Well, first of all, because I wanted to avoid all the teenage boys that were going to be standing in line. And
that's exactly why I went.
You know, I said so much about you.
So now, Sperling, you saw 20 minutes and it blew you away of Avatar, visually, technically. What did you think when you saw the movie as a whole? You started to tell us, but please go into detail. Did you find the visuals held up? Was it just as immersive and exciting as you found it at the first blush, or what was it?
I thought that the story definitely was derivative, as I said, but that the visuals did hold up and there was enough of a story and it provided enough of a kind of driving narrative that I was caught up in it. I really enjoyed it. Is it the best movie ever made? No, but is it one that you'll remember? Absolutely. Some of those visuals and some of those effects are unbelievable. And the fact that they actually even had any semblance of a story was kind of a bonus, because usually the effects are wonderful and you get Transformers too. Great sound, looks amazing. Yeah, but then there's no story.
Let's talk about the 3D-ness of this movie. Sam Worthington was on Conan. Sam Worthington has been doing all the talk shows, by the way, and he kind of stumbles in his sweats, which is very bizarre. Very Australian, I suppose. But Conan said that regarding the 3D, that it's not just like someone like, here, have a pizza. And it's like someone's actually giving it to you, that it like the 3D really like immerses you in the story or something. I'm like, okay, I don't get it. Explain that to me.
Yeah, it does. It really, I mean, they made 3D a part of the story so that you have these huge trees and these mountains that are suspended in midair. And so by adding depth to that, it kind of lent some grandeur to Cameron's vision. And, you know, certainly during the battle scenes and the flying scenes, I mean, you can really get a sense for the spatial difference between two characters. He did a very good job with...
As opposed to Up?
Yeah,
with Up. Other 3D movies?
Yeah.
I mean, I saw trailers for four 3D movies, and they all looked just as good as this film. I saw Alice in Wonderland. I saw Shrek 4 in 3D. I saw Piranha or some silly or... I mean... It looked just like all the others to me. I didn't notice any dramatic difference in the 3D quality of this film than the others.
In Avatar, you had certain scenes where there were 3D objects in the 3D film, which I thought was quite interesting. Specifically, the displays, that was quite cool. I mean, I thought that worked really well.
But by the way, the movie looked like it was colonized first by Maxfield Parrish. Do you know that artist, that painter? He did all these neoclassical Greek and Roman scenes, and they were always in pastels of purple and pink and blue. The whole movie looked like Maxfield Parrish's progeny had propagated throughout the planet. I gave it 1 star out of 4, and I was not looking to trash it. I just literally sat there and didn't feel a single emotion the entire film.
But that was a beautiful use of alliteration, Michael.
Well, before we continue, we should get Paul DeGarabedian from Hollywood.com and Daniel Frankel from TheWrap.com to join us to talk about not only this past weekend's box office, but the box office for 2009. I'm just going to dial them up on Skype. And okay, joining us now via Skype, both from Los Angeles, I believe, is Paul DeGarabedian, who is the topper or the head of the box office division at Hollywood.com, as well as Daniel Frankel, who is the box office reporter for The Wrap, which can be found at TheWrap.com. They are here to talk to us about this year's historic $10 billion North American box office. And you had a great story, Daniel, in the on The Wrap about how there are fewer movies this year that are creating this huge box office.
I mean, if you talk to the studios, you know, their viewpoint is that kind of a classical one. Down economy drives people into the theaters. It increases demand for their product. It's more expensive than ever these days to take your family to the movies. But compared to other entertainment options, people find they get a lot of value out of it. That said, you know, not everybody agrees with that. There are other factors involved. I mean, I think premium ticket prices with 3D certainly factored into it. Another one is one of the studio distribution heads told me there was just good movies this year. There was some real surprises. You know, Sandra Bullock movie, you know, she never had opened a movie above $30 million, and she had two this year, The Proposal for Disney and The Blind Side for Warner Brothers, that greatly exceeded anything she'd ever done. You know, things like The Hangover at Warner Brothers, R-rated comedy that just did tremendous business for them. So, you know, in addition to things like Harry Potter, Ice Age 3, is it? The franchises that performed typically well, you had a lot of big surprises. So I think that drove the market this year.
Well, there were some franchises last year, too, with The Dark Knight and Indiana Jones and Madagascar. But it seems like this year's franchises did a little bit better. Would you say that's true, Paul?
Yeah, I think everything did better overall. And I was a proponent of the idea that the recessionary movie going, as we call it, or that the recession has provided a very strong framework for going to the movies. You know, I was a big proponent of that. But now I'm starting to think, you know, it just really still just comes down to the movies, you know. And this year, I think, as Daniel alluded to, or he mentioned about a studio chief saying, you know, the movies were really good. I think that's it. They were very appealing. It was a good crop of films. You know, I don't care if we're in recession or we're flush with money. You know, nobody wants to see a crappy movie. And no matter how much money you have in your pocket, if you spend that $10 or $12 on a movie ticket and the movie doesn't deliver, you're not going to go back. But when people go see a film like Transformers or Harry Potter or Up or The Hangover or New Moon and they have a great experience, they're going to go back. On top of that, we've had a lot of really good critically acclaimed films such as Precious, Up in the Air, The Hurt Locker. So we've had the mix of both the really, you know, big blockbusters, the typical franchises, remakes, movies based on other, you know, on books or other media, and those have done well. But we also have had some really tremendous, you know, smaller, more independent-minded films that don't necessarily put a lot of money in the box office bank, but they do generate a lot of goodwill and prove that you can have quality films out there while at the same time having a big box office year and, you know, the first $10 billion year ever. So it's pretty impressive. I think moviegoers are pretty spoiled. I think it's going to be interesting to see if 2010 can live up to or surpass 2009. But it has been a very interesting year to be tracking this, with records being broken from the beginning of the year, you know, the first $1 billion January, up to now. We had the biggest Thanksgiving ever, and I think we're going to have probably the biggest Christmas Day ever. So there's a lot to crow about out there.
Now, Daniel, this is Michael. I was wondering, the drop in movies that were released, is that high-end studio releases, or is it mostly the smaller marginal films? Did the studios really scale back?
I haven't seen a comparative number aggregate for the major studios, but there seems to be an agreement that there were less independently financed films, smaller films in the market this year. The decline was, and that decline varies from source to source. I know Paul's accounting had it, the drop off a little less than year, less this year than others tabulated it. The agreement is that there's just less money out there to finance films.
Well, I noticed that you mentioned in your piece, we were off nearly 20%. There were 20% fewer films made in 2009, about 520, which is down from the high of 631 in 2007. Do you think that's a trend that will continue, fewer films making more of the money?
Well, I mean, if you listen to the studio distribution heads, Paramount, for example, didn't finish at the top or really near the top in terms of market share this year, revenue-wise. But they're very quick to point out that their batting average was very, very high.
There are not only fewer indie films or smaller films, but more importantly, there have been fewer wide-release films this year. And even if it's not a huge difference, but if you think about it, if your average studio film, big studio film, makes even $50 million at the box office domestically, you know, if there's 10 fewer films, that's potentially, you know, $500 million less revenue in a given year. But in this year, that hasn't seemed to hurt us, because on a per film basis, you know, they've really been knocking it out of the park. And I think it's not about quantity, it's about quality. But it is interesting. I mean, the theatrical side is booming right now. You know, these companies on the global level are, you know, not as financially secure as they once were. And the credit crunch definitely makes it harder to make more movies. But they seem to be doing quite well in terms of box office. But it's a very interesting scenario that we're in right now.
Well, now, ticket sales are also up about 3.6%, according to Exhibitor Relations. And Daniel, thank you very much for that figure. That's where I'm pulling it from, is your story. And I guess box office would kind of dipped a little bit in 2006, and it's slowly making its way back. Overall, this decade, the zeros or the noughts, are ticket sales up from the 90s, and is obviously revenue is up from the 90s, but so are ticket prices. So is revenue up in a way that ticket prices didn't affect the outcome?
You know, it's interesting, because if we go back to, let's say, 1990, there were 1.2 billion tickets sold, and the box office revenue was $5.1 billion. And at the time, that was considered a massive amount of money. Fast forward to 2009, and we're going to be at double that. But the box office, in terms of attendance, if we go back to 2002, 1.6 billion tickets were sold. That's a contemporary record. This year, we'll end up with about 1.4 billion tickets sold, but that's the highest level in 5 years. So, you know, we had a real nice peak there in 2002. 2005 was that year of the box office slump, the dreaded 18 weeks of downtrending box office. So in 2005, we didn't even break the 1.4 billion tickets sold mark. So we've seen our ups and downs, but considering where we were in 2005 and that people were tolling the death knell for theatrical distribution of films, to be sitting here with, you know, 1.4 billion tickets sold and a $10 billion year, I think that's striking. And I think it tells you the story of how, you know, important going to the movies is as an entertainment option for people and what a viable business it still is.
And Paul, this is Michael. We get caught up in year-to-year comparisons and this year to that year. But if you compare the knots to the 90s, we've sold more tickets. However, whatever the price is, whatever the about, we've sold more tickets this decade than last decade. And we sold more tickets in the 90s than the 80s. And we sold more tickets in the 80s than the 70s. Isn't that true? So the trend has always been upwards.
But again, we won't be at levels like we were in the 30s and 40s and during the Depression where they ran movie theaters 24 hours a day and 60 million, 70 million people a week were going to the movies. But again, there weren't very many other entertainment options. So in today's world of all these high-tech options for getting entertainment delivered, it's actually gratifying to know that people still love to go and sit in a theater in that communal experience with other people and watch a movie on a big screen. You know, there's no substitute for that theater-going experience. If we can just keep, you know, stop people from texting and being on their phone or, you know, using their phones during the movie, then we'll really have something there.
Well, now, Daniel, you mentioned some of the films that have helped create a $10 billion box office this year. What were the big releases besides the Harry Potters? What helped create that this year?
Lack of originality. That's in a simple phrase. That is it. I mean, if you look at the top 10 films, number one this year, Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen from Paramount, did $402.1 million domestically. Next was Harry Potter, The Half-Blood Prince, $302 million domestically. You have Up in The Hangover, 3 and 4. Those are original non-franchise titles. But right after that, you have Twilight Saga, New Moon, Part 2, Star Trek, part of a venerable franchise, Ice Age, X-Men, Origins, Wolverine, Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian. It goes on and on. You look at something like Avatar this weekend, which is a very good movie. Fantastic word of mouth. The company CinemaScore, which is sort of the arbiter of word of mouth, gave it the highest rating, an A. Very well reviewed. But the most it can do is, you know, half of what a New Moon will do on its opening. It's not because it's a bad movie that will do unsuccessfully. It just doesn't have the kind of endemic built-in franchise audience.
I know that they were calling it the highest gross for a film that was not based on a franchise, the highest opening weekend for a non-franchised film, which I thought, are they trying to spin this as being a good box office for it? Because it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, of course they are, and for good reason. I mean, that figure they're quoting is a global number, and they're just trying to put it into some very useful context. You know, if you're going to be compared to Harry Potter, Transformers, Twilight, you need to make it very clear to the public that this is an original franchise we're launching from scratch here. It's not something that we have a lot of books out in the marketplace, previous movies. It's not a recognizable brand to people. So, it's fair for them to ask for that handicap.
Paul, what did the studio say to you when they had to report that the midnight screening was 3.4 million? They must have just, I mean, their hearts must have been in their throat.
When you look at the midnights, let's say on New Moon, which were like 26, or, you know, at Harry Potter, which was like 22, that's when you have to start the spinning. It's like, well, this is for a for an original film, one that doesn't have a built-in audience that was fairly in line with what those films do. But again, once you have a film earning $72 million in a single day, as New Moon did, or $68 million in a single day when Dark Knight did that, it just keeps raising the bar. So the pressure is definitely on filmmakers and studios to make these impressive numbers. And, I'm part of the problem because I track all these numbers, but I'm a film guy at heart and I just want to see really good movies. And there's some great movies that don't necessarily make a lot of box office, but there's some of the best movies and most satisfying experiences out there.
Well, and certainly when we look at the box office of Avatar, if people just talked about the U.S. box office, it might have looked a little scary. But when they could say Avatar grossed $240 million worldwide, people go, okay, well, that's a substantial amount of money. And they're going to hold off before they say, oh, that $3 million midnight screening was a disaster. They can, you know, take a step back, be a little more savvy, and maybe wait a couple weeks and see how it plays out worldwide.
Good point. That's exactly right. And that's why Fox definitely wanted to emphasize that worldwide number because, you know, in the wake of a $142.8 million opening on New Moon, everything else seems puny. And suddenly the bar is raised to the point where if you don't open with $100 million, you're considered a loser. And I remember when earning $100 million total domestic box office was the benchmark, was a blockbuster. Now it's $100 million in a weekend.
Well, before we let you go, I mean, this is, you know, in the 90s and 80s, people started to, and the general public started to pay more attention to the box office figures, what came in first place each weekend. It seems that because of blogs and because of the internet, even more people are writing about it. Even more people are talking about it in the media. How has covering box office and working in box office figures changed over the last 10 years, if at all?
It's, you know, what's changed, and I think you're right, technology has made it where, and we talk about the Twitter effect, but there's also the Facebook effect, and there's, you know, texting. It's more instantaneous now than ever. I remember when I first started out, doing the Sunday estimates was like, you know, something kind of new. I didn't really have to do it every week, and it was such a wonderful world back then. Now, you know, this data comes out all the time. It's everywhere, and it's really just how you interpret it and analyze it that makes everybody different, and there's a lot of people out there doing it. It's definitely a changing world. I think the perceptions are different too. And really quickly, I just want to say that 2009 was very interesting in that, you know, one or two movies made the difference between this $10 billion year or not. I mean, if you were to take New Moon out of the equation, there's $275 million domestically that, when by the end of the year, probably closer to $300 million, that would not have been in this marketplace. So that's very key. One or two films can make all the difference. And that film, about 80% of those tickets bought by women. So women extremely important at the box office. But as far as tracking it and how it's changed, you know, like Daniel said, I mean, that the lack of originality is kind of stunning sometimes. But I think it's more about the ubiquitous nature of this information and how easily accessible it is today.
Well, Paul DeGarabedian, your work can be found on Hollywood.com. And I appreciate, and I should say, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Do you have a Twitter account or?
Well, I have a blog called Hollywood on the Run, and it's at hollywoodontherun.com.
Okay, perfect. And Daniel Frankel from therap.com, thank you for joining us. Do you have a Twitter account or Facebook fan page that we should be plugging here?
Follow my stuff on www.therap.com and post comments. If you could keep the profanity out of the belligerent ones, that'd be great with me.
Okay, perfect. We'll make sure to do that.
Thanks.
Well, thank you both for joining us to talk about 2009's $10 billion North American box office.
All right, well done, Jay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, well, I'm so sorry. It was good of them to talk to us, and I forgot to mention to encourage them to deal more with international box office. But they told us a lot of interesting things about the year in movies.
Well, I thought it was really interesting what, and I love saying his name, Derek Gabedian, said that, you know, women finally matter at the box office.
They should. They're half the population. But yeah, with The Blind Side and Twilight, women were in full force. Did you see that ridiculous New York Times Magazine article about can Hollywood make a movie for women? It's like, what are they talking about?
Oh, is that the one where the New York Times reporter was interviewed?
It was a story about, you know, it's complicated.
Oh, okay.
The Meryl Streep, Alec Baldwin. It was just a ridiculous article. But anyway.
There have been a lot of articles about this because of the success of women's pictures.
That's why I don't understand the headline. Can Hollywood make a movie for women? Like, they do it constantly. They've been doing it throughout their history.
Well, the headline should have been, will Hollywood make movies for women? Because there are so few of them. Because there are so many men who run this town, and they don't want to make women's pictures. And I know that there are plenty of men out there who only want to make boy pictures. And because there are so many male executives, that's what happens. And it's so strange because there are so many females who are at the very top levels, but they seem to be so afraid of pissing off men that they don't want to make, you know, chick pictures.
So no, by boy pictures, you mean like Brokeback Mountain or Far From Heaven or...
I mean a lot of, like, you know, comic book movies.
I know what you mean.
It just seems to be that, okay, I'm going off on my feminist tangent.
Well, that's obviously that, Hollywood history. They were built on women. Women wrote the majority of the scripts in the early days. They were producing, they were directing movies. They dominated screenwriting. And there's a huge history of women's films, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, all these classic female stars where they made movies that were women's films. And I think they're still there today. They should be just as prominent as they always were. But certainly you had this year, you had Twilight, and you had The Blind Side and The Proposal and Julie and Julia.
And I'd say that that was an anomaly.
Well,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, there is one less actress in Hollywood. Actress Brittany Murphy passed away over the weekend at the age of 32. Once again, TMZ.com broke the story. They were the website, kind of a rumor, gossipy website. They broke the story about Michael Jackson's death back in June, and now they were breaking the story on Sunday morning.
They broke Heath Ledger, too. I know somebody called me, and they were like, Brittany Murphy's dead? I'm like, really? Like, well, I mean, it's on TMZ, so I'm like, well, then Brittany Murphy is dead. TMZ is always right.
Well, I was actually notified by email from one of our listeners.
Really?
Very cool.
It's an unfortunate story. At this point, they're saying that she was suffering from the flu for the previous week and that she was on some prescription medication to help her with her flu symptoms. Of course, when a
so
young...
So when was cocaine a prescription medication?
Well, and that's where I was going. Of course, whenever somebody who dies like this, whether it's Heath Ledger or Brittany Murphy, you know, immediately rumors begin to swirl that it had to do with drugs. So far, the only explanation is that she had a cardiac arrest, a heart attack, which is precisely what Michael Jackson died from. But you can, cardiac arrest can be caused by many different things. Yes, drug abuse, certainly, but also swine flu, potentially. It's a sad story, made even sadder by the fact that these rumors immediately begin to swirl. Simon Monjak, her screenwriter husband, did not want to allow an autopsy, according to TMZ. And the coroner overruled him as...
Well, it's not the family's call. They have to do an autopsy when the cause of death is unclear. So,
well, they don't have...
It's not that they overruled him. If you're not clear why someone died, you have to do an autopsy.
You don't have to.
I'm not sure that's true, yeah.
But it's the coroner's call when something like that happens.
I'm pretty certain that if somebody dies and they bring in a body and they don't know exactly why they're dead and they're 32 years old, the coroner's going to do an autopsy. They need to know why they died because you want to eliminate foul play. That's what they're there
for.
Well,
they can do that if there's suspicion of foul play.
Well, anyway. At this point, the police are saying that it does not look like there was any foul play. If you asked Perez Hilton, I can't remember the name of his website. Is it
PerezHilton.com?
Yeah. He kind of let fly right after Michael Jackson died with a bunch of salacious stuff and, pointing towards drugs. And
I think he did that on accident. I don't think he realized that Michael Jackson had actually died.
Yes, that is correct. He kind of was saying things that as if he were still alive.
Yeah, something like he's just making it up so that he doesn't have to do his tour or something like that.
Right, which, believe it or not, Michael, you and I were told by Roger Friedman in Cannes this year that he was going to fake something so that he didn't have to do his whole tour, that he would only have to do like 10 shows. But if you look at Perez Hilton's Twitter feed, he went on and on about how Brittany must have died from a drug overdose. And he posted on Twitter that Lindsay Lohan and Courtney Love must, quote unquote, get it together before they end up like Murphy. He also stated that...
Why are you repeating what he said? I could care less what he said, but this is just...
Well, here's what I find. I understand. I know. I totally know what you're saying. Why should we give him any more space to even talk about it? But what I find really rather alarming is, like, why is nobody suing him?
Well, he hasn't done anything actionable. They're public figures. It's just distasteful and obnoxious.
But it's malicious. You could argue that that is malicious. And if you are a public figure, that's what you have to prove, that it was malice.
Yeah, he says, Dear at Lindsay Lohan and Courtney Love, wake up. Please go to rehab again and get it together before it's too late. And
in so doing, if an insurance company takes a look at that and for whatever reason actually believes that Perez Hilton is not a complete a-hole, sorry, Sperling, it's not a complete a-hole.
Thank you.
They could elect to not insure
their film,
Lindsay
yeah,
Lohan, and then they are preventing her from making a living.
The other big news story.
Talk about the Golden Globe nominations.
Exactly. That's where I was. Yay. Wow. It's like you took the words out of my mouth. So yeah, the Golden Globe nominations were announced this week, and the Golden Globes are often seen as kind of a prediction meter or an indication as to where the Oscars are headed, although I personally don't think so.
Yeah, no, but they, it's fact, they are, but should they
be? They've always had twice as many chances to be right. They've always had 10 movies to name when the Oscars only have 5, so they have a pretty good chance of hitting 4 out of the 5 movies. But now this year, they've got 10 films, and Oscar has 10 films, so now we'll have a lot better look at to see how they match up exactly.
Well, and the Best Feature Drama category, Avatar made the list, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds from Quentin Tarantino, Precious, and Up in the Air, Jason Reitman's film. For Best Feature Comedy, 500 Days of Summer,
woohoo!
The Hangover, the $100 million R-rated comedy, It's Complicated, which has yet to even be released, Julie and Julia, another Meryl Streep film, and Nine. For actor in a drama, Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart, George Clooney for Up in the Air, Colin Firth for A Single Man, Morgan Freeman for Invictus, and a surprise, Tobey Maguire for Brothers. For actress in a drama, Emily Blunt for The Young Victorious, Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side, Helen Mirren for The Last Station, Carey Mulligan for An Education, and Gabourey Sidibe for Precious. She plays Precious in the film. Now, for actor in a comedy or musical...
Are we really going to...
No, I'm going to... I'm not going to read the whole thing. do we want to go into actor for comedy or musical or no?
You started
well,
not, it.
If we're going to... Yeah, besides, you started it.
You get to mention JGL again, so do it.
I don't even know what okay. Matt Damon for The Informant, Daniel Day-Lewis for Nine, Robert Downey Jr. for Sherlock Holmes, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I guess is JGL to Michael Giltz, for 500 Days of Summer...
Woohoo!
Michael Stuhlbarg for A Serious Man. Now, actress, comedy or musical, I find this interesting. Sandra Bullock again, so her second nomination, this time for The Proposal. Marion Cotillard.
What the hell?
Hey, you know, I don't write the news, I just report it. Marion Cotillard for Nine, Julia Roberts for Duplicity. Yeah, they're smoking crack. Meryl Streep.
Absolutely, one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah, but
one of
best
the worst
actress?
Movies of the year, no question. I thought that was such a piece of shit.
Hey, we're a family show. Meryl Streep gets the last two nominations, one for It's Complicated and one for Julie and Julia.
Yeah, that sucks. I mean, she has no chance of winning.
She's going to split the vote herself.
Herself? That should not be allowed.
Well, I was just happy to see Christoph Waltz made it for Inglourious Basterds for Best Supporting Actor.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who we'll just call an industry insider, who said that she didn't think there was a chance in hell that Kathryn Bigelow would be nominated for an Oscar for The Hurt Locker.
What?
Because, because she's a woman. And I was like, that threw me. No way. I think there's, of course she will. I really think that she will.
Not only will she be nominated, but she has a good shot at winning, except...
I think so, too.
James Cameron very well may kind of...
No way. He's already got it for Titanic. He's not going to win for Avatar.
She won't win because I think that this town is sexist enough that they would never give it to a female.
Yeah, but you know
what?
She's a guy's gal. She's made action films and tough movies, and this is a war movie.
Totally irrelevant when you've got... Cameron, Eastwood, Reitman, Tarantino up for it. Totally irrelevant. I wouldn't be surprised if they gave it to Eastwood.
No, not for Invictus. Invictus won't even get nominated. Well, I don't think it will. It'll maybe get like an acting nomination for Freeman or Damon, but I don't think that's going to get a Best Picture nod and director. It's fallen off the screen. It's got mixed reviews. I don't think there's any momentum for that movie.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was up for director, simply because people like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Well, of course, the Golden Globes also nominates... television series, and I'm not going to go through the whole list. We will.
Where was Lost?
I don't know.
It's Lost, like it should
lost
be.
Lost was Lost.
Hasn't been good for years.
Well, I will place a link to all of the nominees in the show notes rather than go through them here.
But Glee. I'm happy that Glee's in there. I'm glad that Dexter's still in there. I was really glad Glee did well and got some good notice for the actors in it too.
What is Entourage doing there?
It doesn't belong.
Now you're talking about best television series, comedy, or musical. Also in that category, besides 30 Rock, Entourage, Glee, is Modern Family, Karen.
Yay!
Your new favorite show. We're going to be
talking about The Office.
And The Office, my favorite show. Now, did any of you read this story in The Hollywood Reporter about how the Oscars could boost their ratings?
No, let's say.
The Hollywood Reporter is saying that one way to boost the Oscars ratings is to show trailers or scenes or clips from upcoming unreleased movies. And it's quite frankly, not a bad idea.
We'll premiere them on the show.
Right, precisely. And not make them a commercial, but say, here's a film that's coming up next year.
Except that it's in February, so there aren't tons of things necessarily ready that haven't been seen already. You got to plan in advance to introduce it on that show. You know, you've got to have the movie and have the trailer ready and have them not show it anywhere else first.
Well, the Oscars were started as a way to promote the film industry. And so that's exactly what they would be doing by showing these trailers. And I would think, Michael, that if they did start doing this and it was successful, studios would hold their trailers back until they could premiere them on the Oscar
telecast.
It'd
be part of the marketing plan. I agree.
And they're saying the idea is that they could be sort of anything. It doesn't have to be actually just a trailer. Like, we've seen the trailer for Iron Man, but as long as you're showing us footage we haven't seen before, and obviously your goal will be to show something really fun and exciting, then you could do that on the show. So even if we've seen the trailer for Iron Man, if there's some other scene they wanted to preview, but how are you going to, who's going to decide? I know they're talking about a lottery, but, you know, the nightmare decision of if you pull five movies out and they're all from the indies, you know, how are you going to decide what movies to show? Do only the major studios get to participate?
Well, the Oscar telecast will be aired on television sometime in March, I think March 7th. And this is my horrible segue into the television news of the week. And Michael, you highlighted something here about a rumor that Simon Cowell will actually be leaving American Idol. And I did not see a donkey fly by or a chicken walk in with lips, so...
No, I've heard that before too, actually. He's been saying that for a while.
Well, this one was from the New York Post, and it was he was quoted in the British papers. And basically the idea is that his contract's up in May, and they might just shut down American Idol and start up the X Factor in the U.S. The X Factor is basically the American Idol in the U.K. You know, American Idol sprang from Pop Idol, which was the show that Simon Cowell did originally with Nigel Lithgow and the others. And Pop Idol came to the U.S. and became American Idol. But then back in the U.K., Simon Cowell bigfooted Pop Idol with his own show called The X Factor, which is basically the same idea with the twist that the judges mentor certain groups and pick certain groups to back and sort of compete with each other to make their groups as good as possible. It adds sort of a rooting interest in it rather than where the judges are supposed to be, you know, above it all and impartial. The one thing that made it interesting was that they said Paula could be back too. You know, he's already getting a ton of money from the show. He might just want more control because obviously they could take American Idol and just adapt the X Factor format to it. So it's all up to Simon, I guess. And he's talking about it, doing it with Fox. He wouldn't agree to do it, I don't think, in the fall while Idol was in the spring. He'd want to be the only show on the air. Maybe he'd take it to another network. And they would say rather than letting him take it to another network, they'll just shut down Idol and start up the X Factor. It's the first sort of convincing rumor that I've heard in a while about this.
He gets $35 million a year. That's pretty...
It's a huge, massive worldwide success. They should.
I'm surprised that's all he gets.
Well, another story in television, and I had no place really to put this. I didn't know whether to put it in movies or TV, but since the website is called YouTube, I figured, well, it's probably television.
It should have been movies.
Right, but it's basically a movie story. Fede Alvarez, and his full name is Federico Alvarez, and now one of my friends on Facebook. I'm going to try and get him on the show to talk about...
Oh, that's so cool, really?
Yeah, I've been going back and forth with him. We'll see if we can get him to talk about his...
That would be great.
Nearly five-minute short film that cost him a whopping $300 to make, although he's from Uruguay, so he probably was not paying in dollars. The name of it...
He was paying in goats.
Oh, that's... I'm not...
That is terrible.
Yes. Ataque de Panico. Panic attack. It featured giant robots invading and destroying Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it...
I saw it.
Pretty amazing, actually.
Well, here's what I think. Here's what I think. Totally amazing. No question about it. Has the guy proven that he can tell a story? No.
No, he's proven that he's got some really great visuals and that there might be a story there somewhere in there. He posted this thing.
There. This is what I'm talking about. Like, people get so excited about this, about a director like that. Like, let's sign him up to do Transformers 3. Where's the story? I see no story. Remember when movies used to involve stories?
Well, the story here is, you know, it used to be that musicians would be discovered on YouTube. Now we've got a filmmaker being discovered on YouTube.
But he's not a filmmaker.
Well, he made this short film that he posted on YouTube.
But there's no story.
At the end of November 2009. And he now has a $30 million deal to make a film with Sam Raimi, whose credits include Spider-Man and all of the Evil Dead films.
And by the way, the currency in Uruguay is the peso, the Uruguayan peso.
By the way, I didn't know that that's what the title of the film was. Say that again, because it sounded really sexy when you said it's Sperling.
Ooh, hold on. Let me put on my deep Spanish voice.
Because now that I know that it's
Ataque
called...
Ataque de Pánico.
Yeah, oh, I like it. Now that I know that it's called that, if you go back and you watch it again, like, that's what a panic attack feels like. It totally does. They're coming.
It's pretty amazing, actually. I mean, he only spent $300 on it, but I wouldn't be shocked if he spent 5 years making the thing.
No, I agree. I think it looks amazing. It really looks amazing. But
well, I need to start posting videos on YouTube, I guess.
I know, right? I mean, but to me, in terms of like a story and a story arc and those old-fashioned notions of telling a story, the best story is the fact that the guy got discovered on YouTube.
Why didn't the little kid who went to the dentist, why didn't he get a TV deal and an acting job, Sperling?
Now, I know what you're referring to. You are talking about the most watched videos of 2009 on YouTube. And the top one, of course, was Susan Boyle from Britain's Got Talent.
I dreamed a dream.
That still gets me, okay?
120 million views. Now, David After the Dentist, I have no idea what the heck that is. 37
million.
Oh,
that's so funny. But it's funny for like 1 second and it goes on and on and on. That's the one about the kid who like had...
He's zoned out on drugs.
He's zoned out on drugs. And he's in this little seat in the back of the car.
Then there was the JK wedding entrance dance, which is that dance where everybody kind of like walks down the aisle to this...
I wonder if they got any money from The Office, because The Office did a lovely tribute to that in there when they got married on the show. I thought that was really cute.
Yeah, it's a good question. I wonder if they did.
Then is the New Moon movie trailer with 31 million views. And the Evian Rollerblades, or no, Evian Roller Babies, 27 million.
That I don't know what that
chicks, or is that little babies who are rolling?
I have no idea. Now, most watched music videos on YouTube, I could care less about, so I'm not going to go into that.
I'm sure I've never even heard of them.
Miley Cyrus,
The Climb, baby, who was up for a Gold Globe until they found out that she didn't write it for her movie, so she's not eligible anymore. But it was good of her to tell them.
Well, speaking of music... Another poor segue. Michael, you have highlighted a number of music stories for this week, including the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees being announced.
Absolutely. A new batch of inductees. A bunch of songwriters are in, which is very cool. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. These are all people from New York and from the Brill Building era, plus Jesse Stone, Mort Schumann, and Otis Blackwell. All those people are happy to get in. It's an award for non-performers. David Geffen also got in as a label executive. But the big name are the new artists who get to join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. ABBA, The Stooges, Genesis, all eras of Genesis, Jimmy Cliff, and The Hollies all get in. So left off the shortlist are Kiss and Red Hot Chili Peppers. Neil Diamond wasn't even on the shortlist. I can't believe Richard Thompson isn't in the hall already. And unfortunately, ABBA probably will not reunite to perform at the induction ceremony.
Ooh.
Well, isn't one of them, I guess it's a duo, right?
No, it's four of them.
Four of them.
Two girls and two guys.
But isn't one of the girls kind of like agoraphobic? She doesn't go outside anymore?
You know more than I do.
That actually sounds familiar to me. There is a weird story there.
I think that maybe they could get a kind of a tribute band to play for ABBA. What do you think?
I think it would be inappropriate in this circumstance, but if they had one, I would go see them.
Well, I have to say, I have seen a tribute band for ABBA play at the Hollywood Bowl of all places, and they were fantastic.
The real ABBA?
Well, they played...
A tribute band.
It was a tribute band, an ABBA tribute band. Before opening for the ABBA tribute band was a Neil Diamond tribute band called Super Diamond!
Yeah,
What the hell were you doing at this concert?
I have no idea. I asked myself that
I
was going.
Why wasn't I there?
Well, you also highlighted a story, Michael, on the people meters coming to radio. This is an old story, though. I mean, I knew that this had happened a while back.
Yes, but they're starting to get the information out, and it's free, and the tests are freaking people out. What's happening in the record industry and the book industry and the radio industry and the TV industry, they've switched from sort of guesstimating what people are doing. They call up record stores and say, hey, what's selling really well? And they would tell them. And then the record labels would give them lots of cocaine to push their record up the chart, even if it wasn't actually selling. So it was this whole murky, vague estimate at what people were doing. Nowadays, in a lot of the industries, they're actually measuring literally what people are buying, what people are watching, what people are listening to. It rocked the Billboard, you know, charts when that happened. It's rocking the book industry when they're sort of measuring exactly what people are buying. And now it's happening in radio. They've been dragging their feet. You know, we've had people meters in TV since for 20 years now. And we've had SoundScan in the record chart since 1991. So radio is really dragging its feet. They're really scared because it always changes from what they think is happening. And in fact, there are very few classical radio stations left in the country. There are only about 20 left. And they just lost a lot of viewership according to the People Meter. People like to say they listen to classical music, but they don't. Guys are listening to Celine Dion because soft rock radio appeals more to guys than they thought. Latino radio is taking a hit. Talk radio is down. It's really freaking them out.
Well, Latino radio had no place else to go but down. I mean, one station after another here in Los Angeles went to the Latino format. The biggest country music in North America closed down and switched formats to a Latino format. A lot of indie rock stations here in Los Angeles switched formats to Latino formats. And the excuse that I always heard was that Arbitron, which is the ratings group that puts out these books of radio ratings, the way they do that and compile that is they send out these diaries that you're meant to keep, and they send it off with like $1 or $5 or something, right, something to that effect to pay
very
you for
nominal
your time. And apparently what I was told actually by somebody who worked at Arbitron is that the only demographic that was actually filling them out religiously were Latinos. So they would get all of this feedback from Latino listeners and very little feedback from anybody else. So it looked and seemed as if the Latino audience was listening to radio far more than any other audience. And of course, now with these People Meters, what they're discovering is, no, actually KROQ, an alternative rock station, is one of the biggest radio stations in Los Angeles. Not
a very good radio station once in its day.
Yes.
Also called K-Rock, for those
K-Rock
of us who actually listen to the radio.
Yes. Oh, radio is dead, let's just face it. I'm still debating whether I should renew my XM satellite radio subscription next year or not. When I was on my way to see Avatar all the way in downtown Los Angeles, which may be the first and last time I ever see a movie at that theater.
There's a theater in downtown L.A.?
Yeah, it's at L.A. Live. Regal spent like $1 trillion building this huge theater, and it's got, you know, this red carpet, 800-seat theater for movie premieres. I actually, on my BlackBerry, I tuned into Pandora and connected it to my car radio just through one of those little tape cassette connectors. And was listening
to Pandora the planet, not Pandora the radio device.
No, although ironic, yes. Pandora is the name of the planet in Avatar. But no, I was listening to it on my BlackBerry all the way down to downtown Los Angeles, and I thought to myself, wow, radio is really dead.
Yeah.
Radio is dead.
We know radio is dead, but is theater dead? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, not according to the LA Times. They said that amid the many bloated musicals released over the last 10 years or produced over the last 10 years on Broadway, some originality snuck in. Now, this was Charles McNulty, the LA Times theater critic, who kind of said that, you know, you can blame Mamma Mia or Wicked for some of these, you know, the commercial pressures of turning, I guess, pop hits into Broadway musicals. But that there were a few good original musicals in play, Spring Awakening, Passing Strange, Next to Normal, to name a few. Now, Michael, this is really your beat.
Yeah, and this is a silly complaint. A, it implies that there was never an era when Broadway musicals weren't filled with bloated spectacles. Go back to the 20s and the 10s. They had Follies and Reviews and just absurd spectacles overstuffed with chorus girls and dancing. It's always been filled with bloated spectacles. They said the same thing in the 80s. Cats and Phantom of the Opera are destroying the musical. And they're saying it today. It's not true. There's plenty of good musical theater being performed. And it's always competing with, you know, direct that appeals to a wide audience, just like you see in the movies and TV. But like just looking right now on Broadway, what's playing today on Broadway? You have Billy Elliot, the musical, which is a terrific musical. You have the Chicago revival, which is great. You have a revival of Hair, which was raved about. You have In the Heights, an original musical with a Latino guy telling a story that's not seen on Broadway before.
And it's like, that's actually a very good musical. I don't mean to interrupt you, but
yeah.
if you're in New
fantastic
York, you should see that. I mean, I know the guy who originally wrote it and starred in it is no longer with it, but it's still worth seeing. It's very good.
And one of the American Idols is going to be on it soon, so there you go. One more reason to go. Jersey Boys is one of the best jukebox musicals based on the story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. The Lion King is a landmark musical, an incredibly great production as far as the puppetry. A Little Night Music is a so-so revival with Angela Lansbury and Catherine Zeta-Jones of a great musical. You know, Mary Poppins is a good musical. Next to Normal is a musical about therapy, which got tremendously good reviews. Ragtime's revival was incredibly well acclaimed. Sondheim on Sondheim comes out soon. South Pacific is a great revival. West Side Story is a good revival. There's, you know, there's always a mix of good and bad. And you know, to claim that there's an earlier era where all musicals were intelligent and sophisticated and refined is silly.
Charles McNulty says the theater is down, but not out. And I love this sentence. And he must have worked so hard on this and been keeping it up his sleeve for maybe years. It reads, "Let the Cineplex titillate moviegoers with the porn of global catastrophe, while BlackBerry bashers and Facebook phobes prophesy the decline of civilization as we know it."
Wow.
The real danger to the Broadway musical is not creativity, but the pricing. Sperling, you've gone to the theater every once in a while. It's literally not $125 anymore. Those are the bargain seats. Now it's a Friday or Saturday night. It's $250, $350, and you can't get good seats. You can't even book 9 months in advance and get a good seat. It's becoming like the opera. It's becoming such a rarefied thing that most people just can't do even once, that it's really killing itself. It's really going to atrophy and become this, you know, thing that most people just will never do, just like the opera is today.
It's a really big deal when you actually go to the opera.
Ah, segue alert.
Yes, I finally did a good segue. It's time for our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we determine whether the news stories are worth mentioning or whether anybody should care about them. And the Associated Press is helping us out this week because our first story is about the top entertainment news story of the year. Apparently voted on by U.S. newspaper and broadcast editors surveyed by the Associated Press, Michael Jackson's death is the top news story of the year. What do you think the second one was? Susan Boyle becoming an overnight sensation.
Oh my God. Wow. What a dead news year.
Coming up in number three is the late night swap of Conan O'Brien and Jay Leno. Yeah. Number four, Walter Cronkite, the news anchor, dying on July 17th was, I'm a little shocked that it made the list. The David Letterman affair came in at number five. The Chris Brown assaulting Rihanna came in at number six. Kanye West robbing Taylor Swift of her moment at the MTV Video Music Awards was number seven. The live video explodes on the web, I guess as more of a trend, came in at number eight. And number nine, I think that editors should be shot for this, but Kate and John Gosselin's broadcast split. These were the reality stars, John and Kate plus eight. Now it's just Kate plus eight. Number 10 was Heath Ledger winning a posthumous Oscar. I don't know that that was really such a big news story, but I guess according to the people the Associated Press spoke with, it was. Are these news stories a big deal? Is this list a big deal?
Well, where is Obama's inauguration?
No, it's entertainment news stories. Entertainment.
Oh, I was like, wow, that is really frightening. what was the question then?
Does anybody care about this list?
I say it's a big whoop. They paid too much attention to most of these stories when they happened, and now they're paying more attention to them again on the list.
Oh, I forgot we were doing Big Deal, Big Whoop. Is this a big deal? I always think that lists like this are a big deal because I think they say so much about the population and popular culture and what we care about. And as alarming as we think it is that we care about John and Kate, from maybe just a personal standpoint, I find this kind of interesting.
Well, our next story, rather than explain it to you myself, I will let my good friend, Conan O'Brien, explain it to you.
Shocking news from the music industry. The controversial singer Chris Brown, the former boyfriend of Rihanna, just announced he's abandoning his Twitter account. That's right, Andy. That's right. He's abandoning
his... It's so close to Christmas,
too. I know, I know. I know, old pal. The lack of new tweets from Chris Brown is going to undoubtedly leave a huge gaping void in the lives of many Americans. So let's now take a heartfelt and sentimental look back at some of the glorious tweets that Chris Brown gave us in the past on his Twitter page, Mechanical Dummy. Check him out. Good morning to all the fans. Love y'all. Philly was awesome. Love y'all. Shouts out to Meek Mills and New Boys. Philly, show tonight. Yes, sir. Philly, show tomorrow. Sold out. CT, great show. Love all my fans. Girls rush the stage tonight. Had to do the day-day. Quit playing juke move. LOL. Sold out. Thanks. We'll miss your tweets, Chris.
Okay, enough of that. So, is Chris Brown not tweeting on Twitter a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
The fact that whether he is on a micro level on this actual story, no, it's completely big whoop. But I'm completely fascinated with the celebrities, should they or shouldn't they be on Twitter thing. So from that respect, I kind of consider it a big deal. But this particular story, yeah, big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal because celebrities are finally starting to listen to Karen and shutting down their social networking lives.
That's it. You're right. That is it. They're paying attention to me.
I wonder if Amy Winehouse is on Facebook.
Yeah, well, if she is, they should take her computer away. Our next story is indeed about Amy Winehouse. Demonic child Amy Winehouse out of control at pantomime. I love the way that the Australian newspaper that I pulled this from called it a pantomime. During a production of Cinderella at the Milton Keynes Theater in Buckinghamshire, Winehouse, who was in the audience with parents and children, heckled the cast and kept shouting, "He's effing behind you!" She called out for more than half an hour in the first act, yelling, "Effing Cinders! Prince Charming, marry me!" and branding the ugly stepsister characters bitches, sources said. She then refused to be ushered to a box after the intermission and allegedly launched herself at the front of house manager Richard Pound, pulling his hair, punching him, and kicking him between the legs. Is this a big deal, or is it run-of-the-mill Amy Winehouse news? Michael?
Well, it's a big deal that it's the latest story where she seems to be not totally in control, and you hope she'll keep pulling her act together so she can record some more music, because she's a talent.
Karen?
Big whoop. It's just another celebrity acting out, but that maybe Perez Hilton needs to address.
but why were you confused that they refer to it as a pantomime? That's what they're called.
I was not confused about it. I thought it was funny.
Oh, well, what else would you call it?
A play?
Yeah, but it's not. Well, I mean, to put it in context, when she's shouting out and talking back to the cast, other people in the audience were probably doing it as well. They just shouldn't have been cursing, because these shows, the audience, especially the kids, are encouraged to hiss and boo and call out and go, "He's behind you, he's behind you." That's part of going to a panto. That's part of what you do. So this behavior is
what
not
did you
so
just
insanely.
Call it?
What?
Okay, who are you?
A
are you
panto?
In like the 19th century? What are you talking panto? About?
There's a tradition in England right up to today. At Christmas time, they have pantos and they perform them all over the country, especially with like male celebrities performing in drag as like the ugly stepmother. They do old fairy tales like Peter Pan, and they have big celebrities in drag is a common occurrence. And at the pantos, it's often a first experience for kids at the theater, and it's something like Cinderella or Peter Pan, things like that. And they're encouraged to speak up and talk and gasp and boo at the villain and hiss the villain and cheer the hero. It's a very active audience. You're meant to be engaged, and they play to the crowd and people talk back. This is a very, very English tradition, the pantomime. And so when she's saying, "He's behind you," a lot of people could have been doing that. They just wouldn't have been cursing when they did it. So, you know, Mary, this is not insane behavior except for the cursing. This is what you do at a panto, especially when you're a little kid. Of course, she's not a kid, but that's what happens at them.
Well, earlier in the week, Winehouse's ex-husband.
I'm sorry, just a little theatrical history there for you. I guess he's going to edit that out, isn't he?
I don't know whether to be impressed or scared.
I am a little bit of both. Earlier in the week, Amy Winehouse's ex-husband, Blake Fielder Civil, said he is not only her ex-husband, but will be her next husband. And he said that
really?
The singer, as well as himself, were now off drugs and they plan to remarry. Our next story is also set in England. Rage Against the Machine beats X Factor's Joe to Christmas number one. Now, Michael, why don't you explain a little bit about this, though I'm a little worried about.
There's another Christmas tradition in the UK, and there used to be betting what would be the number one single during the Christmas week. You know, they have weekly charts. And the number one single at Christmas week for decades, I don't know how far back it was, probably the 60s, if not earlier, people would get excited and bet on what they felt would become the number one single. They'd base it on the type of song and who was releasing the song at Christmas time. And eventually, by the 70s, or certainly the 80s at the latest, stars would plan songs and release them to try and become the Christmas number one single. It's a really big deal. Tom Jones
Isn't
would
this
record
what happened, sorry to interrupt, to Bill Nighy's character in Love Actually?
Exactly. And you know, Tom Jones would plan a song to be a, you know, released just then and time it for 2 weeks to hope become the number one. People would really do things or release special charity singles, George Michael. You know, people really wanted to be the Christmas number one. It was a really cool thing. The last about 5 years, it's been a nightmare because The X Factor, which is Simon Cowell's show in the UK, which is a huge hit, the finale had 19 million viewers, which would have made it the number one show in the US, much less the UK. But this show is timed to end right at Christmas, and they release the single the day after the show's over, and so it automatically sells, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 or 600,000 copies, and has been the number one single every year for the past 5 years. It doesn't, you know, in advance that whoever wins X Factor is going to have the number one single at Christmas time because it's just timed that way, and nobody else could beat it. Some fans got really annoyed at this, and they decided to champion a single by Rage Against the Machine, the incredibly alternative group, a song called Killing in the Name. And they decided to promote this old tune from, I think it's 92, and said, everybody buy this song the week of Christmas and make it the number one song. Stop the X Factor. And they did a good thing. They said there would be a charity single. It would raise money for the homeless. Simon Cowell was really annoyed about it, which I thought was not smart of him. He said something like, they're pathetic people and it's just stupid of them. He got very angry that they were doing this, but it worked. They had a huge online campaign, and they sold like 10,000 more copies, I think, than the X Factor song. And it became the first time in like 6 years, the number one song at Christmas was not the X Factor winner. And it was this old Rage Against the Machine tune, which everybody bought on digital download.
Well, I think it's a big deal, if only because the social networking of Facebook and Twitter was able to help make that campaign to unthrone the X Factor's Christmas week number one-ism. I don't know what I'm saying, but
absolutely,
I think that they used the social networking tools effectively and it worked.
I think it's awesome. I totally agree for the same reasons that you said, Sperling, and anything that, you know, Down with the Man or Down with any kind of reality show, I'm behind.
Well, I guess there's a difference in a reality show and a talent show like Idol and So You Think You Can Dance. It's not a show where you watch Big Brother where people just sit in a house and yell at each other. You know, it's a talent show.
Yeah, no, I don't watch any of that crap. I watch talent shows.
I don't watch any of that stuff either.
Our next story is about Access Hollywood, the daily entertainment news show, which obviously copied us, except every day. Nancy O'Dell, the longtime co-host of the show, I guess since all the way back in 1996, she started when the show premiered. She's going to be leaving the show, and her publicist says that she is taken off to pursue a new opportunity. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I mean, let's be real. This is a big whoop, but it's a big deal to me and to people who are, you know, who care about that kind of thing, because she's been with the show for a while, and she's really good. She's one of the few pros out there. I really like Nancy O'Dell.
Like Mary Hart from Entertainment Tonight. Michael.
But not totally annoying. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's a big deal, too. I really like her, too. She was the host of Nashville Star when it began, mm-hmm. which is the country version of American Idol. And they kicked her off that, which is a mistake. She was great on that. She's a real pro. She's very talented. Who knows? Maybe she'll end up at Good Morning America with George Stephanopoulos.
Are you serious?
No, I just made that up, but who knows?
Well, our last story today is about Roman Polanski. Apparently, a California court has refused to dismiss the case against him, but some of the comments are encouraging, at least for him. A California appeals court on Monday rejected Polanski's request that his decades-old sex case either be dismissed or reviewed again by the courts while he remains under house arrest in Switzerland. But it sharply criticized prosecutors for having failed to review evidence of official misconduct in the case and suggested that Mr. Polanski might be sentenced while still abroad, which would be huge. Michael, is this a big deal?
It's a big deal for Roman Polanski and our friend, Marina Zenovich, working on what I think is a follow-up film or an expansion of her movie about him.
Yes, indeed. Karen?
I think this is a big deal.
Okay, then.
And I've got no editorializing on that one for once.
Okay. Well, that brings us to our final segment of this episode, Inside Baseball, wherein we talk about the stories that maybe only some of the folks here in Hollywood might care about. But this week we have a little treat, which is Fox TV's Christmas card. Now, Karen, you highlighted this, but Michael,
I loved this.
Have you seen this?
Yes, I watched it too. It's pretty funny.
Okay, well, let's.
It's the Modern Family.
Yeah, this is the cast of Modern Family, as well as who is it? Gary Newman and Dana Walden,
Dana
the producers.
Walden. No, they're the execs at Fox TV.
The holidays are a magical time of year.
They are a time for family to be together.
For friendships to be cherished.
For overall deals to be reevaluated.
It's the time of year to slow down and remember what's important.
To be thankful for all that we have.
to distance yourself from pilot scripts that aren't getting traction.
Seriously, that's what you're going with on our holiday message?
What am I supposed to say?
I don't know. Maybe something about joy?
What do you know about joy?
What are you saying?
Oh, come on. You always make me the bad guy while you walk around in your little short skirts pretending to be everybody's best friend.
Gary, what is wrong with you?
Oh, please. You want to cut all the actors' salaries.
She wants to cut what?
Our salaries? Oh, that's not cool.
Love her skirts, though.
That's what I heard, Marty. They said they're going to cut our salaries.
Wait, what do you say? Should we walk?
It's voicemail.
I need to speak to Gary Newman and Dana Walden now.
Who?
Just tell me out here.
Yes, Gary Newman, please.
Ooh, I'll take that one.
Happy holidays from everyone at 20th Century Fox Television. May the new year bring you peace, joy, and vertical integration.
See, it's not just me.
Very insighty. But
I love that Gary Newman does not know who the kid is who plays Manny.
He yeah, calls him like,
who?
but then the hot new wife calls and he says, oh, I'll take that call.
I'll take that one.
I love that Cam and his boyfriend are like, Cam is on the phone to his agent saying, you know, they're going to cut our salaries. And his boyfriend's like, what is he saying? Oh, it's voicemail. I'm leaving a message. Because it sure looks like he's listening to him. It's a very funny little holiday treat, and we have to thank Nikki Fink for that. It was on her blog, Deadline Hollywood. We'll place a link to it in the show notes, which can be found at our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find links to all of our social networking sites, including Twitter. We're twitter.com/showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And if you want to email us, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, or Management, as I like to say. You can find them on MySpace. The address to look up is myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
Ooh, Sperling?
Yes?
Can I jump in? I forgot to list this. Here's a big deal we would all agree. MGMT are in Rolling Stone's poll of the best music of the decade. The best albums of the decade, they're at number 18 with their album. And best songs of the decade, they have two songs. They're at number 11 with Time to Pretend, and number 46 with Kids.
Kids opens our show each week.
Exactly. So, way to go, MGMT.
Yes, we should probably look up where they're playing and read it off to you. But instead, we'll tell you where you can find Michael Giltz. Michael Giltz can be found at michaelgiltz.com or on Twitter, twitter.com/michaelgiltz. Karen Woodward can be found on karenwoodwardonline.com as well as on Twitter. Now, what is your new Twitter? I finally got the old one. Now
this
you changed it.
Yeah, this one's easy. Karen _Woodward.
Oh, that's easy. Yeah, you can find her on Twitter, at Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. See how I memorized it. I'd like to thank I'd like to thank our guests, Daniel Frankel from TheRap.com and Paul DeGarabedian from Hollywood.com. I can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com or on Twitter. Sperling is the name to look up. Until next week, play nice.